there's a helping people. But Tom Fire's talking to these funny people. He's asking what they find in the town stories. Can somebody yell out the name of the show, please? It's my mate, Wood Toaster. Oh, it's my mate, Wood Toaster. Yeah, yeah, it's my mate, Wood Toaster.
Hello, welcome back. This is My Mate Bought a Toaster, and this week I'm joined by the fabulous writer, comedian, actor, podcaster, toaster owner, Josh Howie. Josh Howie, hello.
Hey, mate.
How are you?
I'm good. I was just thinking, it's 20 years we've been friends and associates and comrades in comedy.
Flipping heck, is it really? So I think we first met at the Comedy Cafe, didn't we? Something like that, in about, 20 years
ago. One of my first gigs. And so yeah, I started sort of end of February, beginning March, 2002.
I met someone yesterday whose son is, he's 26, and he's just sort of in the last year started doing stand-up, and he's like on the circuit now. He's at that point where he's doing like five nights a week, not getting paid yet. He's been going a couple of years. And I felt pure old man envy for the first time with stand-up. I've always looked back on stand-up and gone, oh, thank God that bit's gone, or that was quite good. Or, you know, I've never had rose-tinted spectacles at all with stand-up. And yet, when she said that, I was like, oh, to be back meeting the Josh Howies in the comedy cafes of this world.
Well, you did meet the proper characters, and it really did sort of broaden your horizons. But when people say I would stand up hard, it's not that hard when you're funny. The problem is it just takes so long to get funny, or it took me a long time to get funny. And that first few years is the super hard years, because you are doing, I was like obsessed. I was doing like 9 gigs a week. I was literally out every night. You're going from one crappy pub in the corner to another pub, and you're doing these 5 minutes, and that was hard. And you're rubbish mostly, maybe one joke, and then you get like 2 jokes that kind of work, and then 3, and it's just such an incremental thing. But that first year or two, where really all that keeps you going is faith,
yes,
because no one else sees it. And I remember my mum coming to one of my first gigs and the idea was I was still living at home, and it was like I would start making a living through stand up, and then I'd move out. And she called my dad, and they were divorced. They do not speak at all, and she literally said, he's mental. How do I get him out of my house? He's never going to make it.
And she was right. She was right.
And she was right. And it did take a few minutes. But her feedback to me after that gig was, that wasn't 7 minutes. That was
all. What do you mean? It felt like 45.
Yes, that was all she could say. That was her only. Although that's better than my mother-in-law. And my wife just reminded me of the story. And you know Monique, because I was with her the whole time of stand-up.
Yeah.
So you met loads of times and through that whole thing. But her mum came to see me do a gig and used to have a bit of a drinking problem. I said, okay, she doesn't listen to podcasts.
Fine, yeah.
And it was like, do you remember Rolly Moe? Do you remember that?
Yeah,
Rolly Moe had a gig in Oxford Street, and it was like in a little pub upstairs, and he was a weird dude.
He used to do a thing with an aeroplane. He'd stand on stage, this old American dude. I say old American dude, Josh. The chances are he was the same age then as we are now. Thanks for coming. there's my first epiphany of the show. And he would hold an aeroplane up, a toy aeroplane up, not a real one, and just go, and it was fucking hilarious. It was piss funny.
Yeah, it was piss funny the first time you saw it. When you saw it, it started wearing a bit thin, but anyway, it was that there was a tiny room. It was like sort of maybe there were about not there was like my mother-in-law and her husband, and then my sister-in-law and her husband and Monique, and then there were like 2 other couples at the front. Tiny room. And I went on, did my set, and I came off and I sat down next to my mother-in-law, and she turned to me and went, so when are you going on? Like, that's how drunk she was.
What do you say to that?
I was just like, wow, I made a massive impression here. I mean, and you got it. The room was so small; it was literally 2 tables in this room.
I think the thing that I often in that situation think about is the belief, the certainty that what you're doing has a goal. Like, it's this weird, you know, it attracts a certain type of personality. We all know that. It attracts a certain type of damaged personality. We'll get into that. But it requires you to have this core, incredibly admirable, almost psychopathic. And I often think of Eddie Izzard for this, because Eddie Izzard is the definition of this. Eddie Izzard was shit for years, and he used to go at it again and again and again and again and again until he worked it out. What is that? What is that little bean from which roots flow? What is that thing?
Well, you're right. And it's two contradictory natures, being incredibly insecure and needing other people's validation, yet having this like innate sense of also this confidence that you are worthy of being listened to. And not only that, you are funny and that you're the funniest person there. So everybody in that room should focus on you. So it's two, and that's, and you need the insecurity as well, because that's kind of that outsider status is where you notice the stuff that becomes your material. So it's a really strange combination. And then there are people who have lots of one. There are people who are really insecure, but like hilarious, but don't have the, so they don't have the ability to sell that stuff, and they have this really great outsider look. So really funny and insecure, but they're too insecure. And then you've got people who are like, have that psychopathic tendency and arrogance. And you remember Alex Lazarus being, now that's like proper.
Oh, what happened to him? Oh, so, my God, there's a whole podcast in well, maybe not a podcast, maybe just a conversation off air of you and I just going, Bill Zimmerman, where's he? Just doing
there's all
that.
These like people we started with and they sort of dropped off along the way. But Alex Lazarus, he was so insanely confident. And I remember seeing him do like this Jeff Whiting gig out in the middle of nowhere, and he did about an hour and he didn't get one laugh. But you know what? He didn't get a heckle either, because he was so confident that the audience just assumed it was their fault, because they were like, either this person is like a comedy genius and we are just too thick to get this, or he's like the most mental person we've ever seen.
He basically scared his audiences. All right, listen, what we're going to do, Josh, I have cracked into your Amazon account. And by the way, thank you so much. You're the first guest ever to put a toaster in the background of the shot. So that really helps me stay focused. Do you know what I mean? If ever I feel we're getting too tangential, the toaster will be a symbol of what we're doing here today. It's wonderful.
Although I didn't buy it from Amazon, so I hope that doesn't break the podcast. By the way, I did want to say, your podcast, it's the best idea. I was so jealous. You know what it's like when you see a comic and they do a joke, oh, that was always out there. Why couldn't I do, you know, there's anger. And when I first saw you post about it, I was just like, oh, fucking Tom, you bastard. It's such a good idea. It's so annoying. I'm so angry. Anyway, but I'm very happy to be here now.
Thanks, mate. That's very kind of you to say. And well, I'm very glad you're here, because we are diving right back into your past. We're going to, not far off, 20 years ago, Josh, 8th of November, 2002, by Patricia Clarkson, The Therapeutic Relationship. You bought a copy of that book. Tell me more.
Wow. Okay. That is a long time. So I'm trying to even look at, can't even imagine. All I can imagine is that I was arguing a lot with my then girlfriend, now wife.
Right.
That would make sense. Or the other thing could be, we'd got together about a year before. So she was and is slightly technically challenged. And I wonder if I bought this book for her because she didn't have an Amazon account or a credit card or any sort of the trappings of modern society. So she's a therapist. Right now she's in the other room, in the sitting room. This is why I'm in the kitchen, because she's in the sitting room doing a therapy session right this moment.
Oh, my God. Are you going to hear you shouting over someone's very sensitive, carefully put together therapy session? You going, Alex Lazarus, he was so confident.
Yeah, oh no. I left the door open because I needed the Wi-Fi to come out of the sitting room. So it's actually much worse than that. She's going to tell me off in a second. So
fine. All right. So Patricia Clarkson, The Therapeutic Relationship, it's got a fascinating. Yeah. So it's for doctors, social workers, teachers, and counselors. Yeah. It's the uses and abuses of the therapeutic relationship in counseling, psychology, psychotherapy, and related fields.
I just wanted my wife to bloody graduate and earn some money. And that's really what that was about. And it's taken 20 years, but she's now doing it, because we had this little detour along the way of having lots of children as we bump into each other in the park, so you know. And so she's been pregnant for the last 12 years. And then now she's finally is being this psychotherapist and earning money, and it's just like, oh my God, the relief.
It must be, for a psychotherapist to be married to a stand-up comic or to be with a stand-up comic, it's a busman's holiday, isn't it, the whole thing? She must just look at you just like, you are just a treasure trove.
You're a mess. Well, I was worried that like that she has somewhat healed me.
Right. Oh, that's a shame.
Yes, and I'm definitely less of a mess. And I'm worried that healing and making me at peace with myself has diminished the comic that I used to be. I'm definitely less angry on stage. Less shouty, and that was the fun, Josh. You're one of the only people who will remember just me losing it with the audience. But now I'm really like amicable and nice, and it's sort of like there's something's gone. I know, charming even.
Well, what I can do, I can come along to your gigs, and just before you go on stage, I'll say, "Hey, you know, my mate bought a toaster. Your Amazon purchase history is a podcast, Josh. That was my idea, Josh." And just watch you scream.
Yeah, yeah, and then just the bile and the venom will. Jealousy will reemerge.
Oh, my days is so embarrassing. I don't remember buying all these silly little strange things. I swear on my life, I was forced by my wife with an ABBA penknife that I bought on ABBA. Wait a minute.
I've been reading the fantastic new book about the Beatles, 1, 2, 3, 4. What I find really enjoyable about the book is that he keeps going into the people who got left behind.
Okay.
I'm not suggesting for a second you and I have been left behind, but let's be honest, as stand-ups over 20 years, we've seen lots of people come by and go on to huge success. And it's things like Pete Best, who was the drummer in the Beatles for 2 years. There's another guy who went and drummed for a couple of months. And there's a lot of them who then spent the rest of their lives sort of spitting every time they saw the Beatles on TV. And I think bile management, because we're all told not to get jaded and not to be bitter. And there's some people who don't, like Mark Olver, lovely boy. He'll always sprint stand up and he's always like, "I'm genuinely happy for people's success." And I think I'm a psychopath because I can't do that. I'm, you know, how do you manage the bile?
Yeah, it's really tricky. And even earlier, I mean, it started early on because it would even be like, I'm sure I've had bile thoughts about you. Like, I'm sure I'd be like, "Oh, Tom's got a 10 spot at the Comedy Cap," or something. You know, like you'd hear like that stuff. It was like, "Oh, he's got 20 on Thursday at the Comedy Store." It's like, "Oh, God, but I did that gig with him and I was just as funny," or whatever. So all of that is there. And it's so desperate at that time.
Yeah.
The hard thing about stand up is that you're just. You cannot get away from the success of other people.
Absolutely.
It's everywhere. You're getting on the tube, you're getting anywhere you go, there are posters, you turn on the telly. And combine that with the sort of, I wouldn't say renaissance because it would suggest that it's good, but the stand-up that's on television now, you flip from one channel to the other, you cannot escape it. Everybody you know, you've been in a car with somewhere, going to Portsmouth for 100 quid or 50, you know, it's all encompassing. And it's and you know, every time you go into a bookshop, every time, anywhere you go, it's just hitting you at your failure. It's not their success that's hitting you, it's your failure.
Yes. And you thought Tom Price getting 10 minutes at the Caff was bad or at the store was bad. Yeah. When you see certain people selling DVDs and you're absolutely right, it's got nothing to do with that person. I don't look at particularly, there's a couple, but I don't look at stand-ups and think, "You aren't that good. How have you done that?" Yeah. I just think, why haven't I done that?
Well, yeah. I think a few things have genuinely helped, having a psychotherapist wife, number one.
Great.
Number two is I actually do try and focus, and then I look at some of the stuff and I just think, I don't want to be on that panel show. I don't want to be that. That's not the comedy I would want to choose. Yes, the money is nice, and I imagine the fame. The other thing is someone like Jack Whitehall, who we started way after me and got instantly massive, but we're friends with, friendly with. I remember doing a gig with him about a couple of years ago, and we left the gig together, walking down the road, like cabs stopping, people stopping. I mean, it's like 11 o'clock at night. He has no peace. And I'm sure that's he's happy with that, or that's part of the price to be paid. But that level of fame is too much.
And every interaction you're being judged. You know that thing where people say, "Oh, Jack Whitehall's a bit of a tosser." And you're like, "Well, you met him once and he was knackered."
Yeah, exactly.
So it's that level of fame where you're being constantly judged. Yeah, sorry, go on. Number three. I'm writing these down.
And then having children is a massive thing, because that just opens your world and takes you away from yourself more than anything else does.
That's an indication of just how jaded and bitter you were that you had to have 19 children. Tell us how many kids you've got, Josh.
I didn't get it with the first two or three. So we should say to the listeners that I have five kids. So by number five, I was emotionally stable. But the first 2 or 3, I was like, oh, screw you guys. Like, what are you doing for me? What have you done for me lately? So it's taken that. Yes, absolutely. That's the.
Isn't your first child called Fuck You McIntyre?
Yeah. That's his middle name. So that's a big help. But I think the need, the ego is somewhat filled by having to, or lessened, you need it or something like that. But definitely that's much, much healthier to just kind of, and also I think it puts life into perspective in a greater way. And it just gets you out of your ambition. Yes. You know, that's supposedly a bad thing, but it's not. Like, guess what? You can be happy and have a happy life. And I am happy. And
I really felt that when I bumped into you, because I hadn't seen you for years, and I saw you at the playground a couple of years ago, just sort of before lockdown. And I thought, God, I really like Josh. Because when we used to chat, we were in the rat race a bit. Yeah. We were in that place pre-kids. Yeah. And we chatted, and I was like, that's what happens when you've had kids. You're just like, oh, what are you like as a person now and not as a mentalist?
Yeah, absolutely. And that,
on the circuit.
And that is lovely. And it was like, and I remember that day, and it was lovely, lovely seeing you exactly for exactly the same reasons. Like, oh, you're a human being. Yeah. It's sort of, you need a reminder of that, and children are the best reminder you ever get of what's important. And just giving up your dreams and all that. Well, I mean, no, but that's the joke. But it isn't actually. It's that your dreams are different, become different peeves, and they're not less valid and stuff. And then and then the other thing that's helped a little bit is I got this Radio 4 series a few years ago, and I did 2 series of that. And I'm really proud of it. And I really was like, and not having had certain chances, and I think, like, you know, seeing all these people going off and flying away in a way, and then I finally got this opportunity and I really gave it everything. And it really, I'm really proud of it. And it exists. And then that led to the other stuff. And so little things have happened since then. So I feel secure as a human being, but I feel secure as a career and the kind of stuff that I'm doing. And I make a living, and it's 20 years.
Totally. Well, that's the thing as well. I think to cap this off, because we mustn't be too self-indulgent, because therapy is happening in the other room, not in this room. But you know, you are not unsuccessful. That is the key thing, isn't it? And it's that thing of going, God, it's really annoying when people say this. You see it in interviews all the time. Never give up, never give up, never give up. But it's fucking true. Oh, you just got to keep going.
It's just staying the course. And it's tough.
Big time.
And the last couple of years, obviously, have been really tough. And then it's waves. And you just have to make sure there's a thing. This is the other thing I'd like to say is, before we do move on to the actual concept of the podcast, is that I read this book, and maybe this book is actually in my bio or whatever. Anyway, but
we can pretend this is part of the podcast then. Nice.
The writer talks about this theory. She starts off, it's called The Worst Day Ever, I think, and she talks about how when she was in LA, she has this theory that people's emotional development halts when they become famous. So like Michael Jackson is set a 7-year-old for his entire life, because the moment that people start saying yes to you and you become famous is like you don't need to develop any further as a human being. So like Ashton Kutcher is like 17, he's famous, and then he's like a 17-year-old for the rest of his life. But then you get George Clooney or John Hamm, they had proper jobs, they worked as waiters, they did all that stuff. They make it in their 30s and they're cool as fuck because they know how life is much more, and they know how hard it is, and they can appreciate it much more that they're there. It's not, so they know what the other side of that equation is, the struggle. And I think I think, to be honest, you knew me back then. I think I'm not saying I'm the perfect human being now, but I think I was a bit of an asshole, or a bit driven, or a bit too focused, or a bit whatever it is. And I feel like the way that it's happened, even though I was frustrated and angry, I think is for much more for the best. Because I think if I had got any level of success early, I would be absolutely unbearable and totally entitled. Yes. And
I feel the same way. And I think also, I feel exactly the same way. And I think it would have lasted a year.
And now I feel like after 20 years, I've got the talent and the skills after those 2 decades to back it up and hopefully have something a bit more long-term and not be a total arsehole during it. So having these opportunities that are sort of coming my way now, I'm just insanely grateful, giving each one the appropriate due that it's worth, you know, because I know what it's like to spend long time with no opportunities and not having any of those options, you know.
So it's totally true, and it's very important. Josh isn't an asshole. He did move the recording of this podcast so he could go and make a sitcom, but that's fine.
Sorry.
That's fine. All right, fine. Listen, let's move on, shall we? 2005 now, Josh. 11th of July, you've bought the Fuji Finepix E550 digital camera. 215 quid you've blown on this bad boy.
Yeah, wow. That camera I kept. So this is a good... Yeah, so I bought this camera. This is obviously pre-smartphones and stuff. Mm-hmm. So you needed digital cameras. This is an expensive thing for me to buy. 200 at that time, I'd been doing stand-up maybe 2-3 years. I was probably still temping a little bit as well, just to get by. I think I was, you know, we'd moved in with my girlfriend then, but I needed this camera. And this is what I told the kids the story on the way to on the school run this morning. I took a photo of my niece holding up a poster I'd made saying, "Dear Monique, will you marry Uncle Josh?" And I took it in the on the screen. And then what I did was, when we were down the beach, which is where I first saw her, not where we met, but I sort of creepily saw her on a rock and thought she was the most beautiful woman I've ever seen and all stuff. Anyway, we were sitting there like to have lunch. This is in Mallorca in Spain. And I said, "Oh, you should check out these cool photos I took of my niece." And so she was flicking through them and she saw it. And then I had the ring out and all that stuff like that. So that camera means something to me. But the bit I didn't tell the kids was that it was, as you say, it was 200 odd quid. It was like the most expensive purchase I had. So in that moment of happiness and joy, I thought, for the first time in my life, I'm going to just put this camera on the rock next to me. You know, and it came with, I had to buy a case as well. That was 20 quid and all this stuff. Yeah. I put the camera down to, you know, live that moment as my wife and my agrees to be my partner in life and all that stuff. And as she just walked into the room, sorry about the screaming, babe. And so I put this rock down and put this camera down to be in the moment of The Power of Now, which may be one of the other books that is on my Amazon buy list somewhere.
Love that book.
Yeah.
Love that book.
And of course a bloody wave came in. And you got to say, I'm so anal, and I was so like protective of this camera because it was so expensive, and I had so much money that every time I got it out or my wife took a photo, I'd be like, put the camera back in the thing, put it back in the pouch, don't. And the one time I just was like, I'm not going to put it back in the pouch. I'm just going to put it here so I can hug and kiss my wife in the moment. Was the time a bloody wave came in and knocked it. I was like, but she thought when she saw it, she thought she wasn't actually meant to see it. So she sort of went past it. Like she didn't realize. And then I was like, did you see that picture? Which was like, yeah. And then she was all like, happy.
You're behind her on one knee.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you just go back?
Find us on Twitter and Instagram. @ToasterPod is the name we're trying to jam. It's simple like a sarnie filled with cheese and ham. @ToasterPod, I swear it's not a scam, I think.
24th of January 2006, the Henry vacuum cleaner. There he is. Look at this domesticity.
He made an appearance, did he? Is that the bags or the actual vacuum cleaner?
Bags and the Hoover, mate. Bags and the Hoover.
Really? Because I thought we bought it from Costco. But maybe I bought that for my grand. I was living at my grandma's around then, I think.
Why were you living at your grandma's?
We were trying to save money to get our flat this wonderful ex-council flat that you see behind me. We moved in together after about a year or so, and it was obviously rent was just insane. We're in a studio room together. Yeah. It was pretty hardcore, and we needed to save some money. And so, yeah, eventually we moved into my grandma's. The idea was that we would be there to help her, make sure she'd taken her medication and not really be carers as such, because she was still somewhat independent, but essentially mooch off her and just use up all the electricity and all that stuff.
Sure.
I think at that time I must have bought a Hoover for our part of the house or something like that.
Part of the deal is we live here rent-free, but we will Hoover everything up.
Do a bit of Hoovering. So,
It's quite nice, you know, moving in with the generation above you.
It was good.
Sweet, isn't it?
We've always been very... She unfortunately died a couple of years ago, but we were always super close. I was at boarding school. My mum, dad, they were working all the time. Any normality that I have is really come from her. Like she actually loved me. Or I felt loved by her. And
oh my God, I could have done with one of those. Oh,
yeah, you didn't get any of that at all?
No. Someone who loved you. Wow, okay, writing this down as well. That sounds good. I went to boarding school as well. Where were you at boarding school?
I was at Dulwich College Preparatory School.
How old were you when you started?
I was 9, I think. And I told this to, and this is a sort of classic humble brag thing, but I was supporting Frankie Boyle on tour a few years ago, and we were just talking about stuff, and I said something to him, and he just couldn't, he thought it was the funniest, and you know what I think, you just don't think about your own life sometimes, you don't realize how mad something is. But I went to Dulwich College Preparatory School, and we lived in Dulwich. I literally lived 5 minutes down the road. And that didn't seem weird to me somehow. But when I told him that, he's just like, are you what? Like, he couldn't believe it. I literally lived a 5 minute walk.
Yeah.
The road from my boarding school.
It took an intervention from Frankie Boyle for you to look at your own life and go,
really messed up. My parents really hated me.
Imagine taking one of your five children now, Josh.
Yeah.
Right? And I assume you've got a 9-year-old in there somewhere in the mix.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, nearly on sale with us there.
A couple of months.
There you go. Imagine taking that child and putting it in a school and then saying, see you at Christmas. What?
Yeah. It's mad.
It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing to have kids and to have someone else in the room with you while you look at your phone. That's what kids are for.
That's what it is. Yeah, absolutely. Giving that iPad away and just be on my phone. And the worst thing is now my eldest is 12, and so he's got a phone now and whatever. Oh, and I'm just, I really get upset with him being on his phone. But I'm just the biggest hypocrite, of course, because I am on Twitter. I'm on my phone all the time. Certainly the last few years, which even pre-COVID, with getting into sort of more political stuff and just absolutely taking over my headspace. It's just wrong. And I just try and explain to him, like, this is bad. This is not the example to follow. You should be looking at me and never want to see a phone again. But no.
So drama. I'm in exactly the same situation. So I'm like, right, no screens, guys. And then I sit down with my phone. They're like, but you're on a screen. Yeah, well, this is a screen. This is actually an extension of my hand.
It affects your brain differently. Your brain is younger. My brain's already messed up or whatever. But,
so true. Yeah. All right, look, here are some books, you know, pre-phones. 2007 still here with Josh Howie on My Mate Bought a Toaster. We've got The Happiness Hypothesis, Putting Ancient Wisdom to the Test of Modern Science by Jonathan Haidt. This is the classic. This goes in the never read that bin, which there's a big one on My Mate Bought a Toaster. The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins, which I have read. And that for me was the moment I stopped having slightly weird wishy-washy faith. That was
that's interesting because for me, it really cemented my faith. And I've got it. And I just took a lot of notes as I was reading it. I was like, for me, it was like, I've got to read the enemy because I'm Jewish and I go to synagogue and I do believe in God. And I trained to be a rabbi and I got kicked out. So I had this sort of brainwashed religious side to me, but I read it. I was like, well, let's see. Everyone says this is the best counter argument to that. Let's delve into it. And I sort of took lots of notes and it felt to me like there were lots of fallacies like this prove that. And it's like, well, that doesn't prove anything, you know? So it wasn't convincing to me. And I thought, well, if this is the best that argument has, then I'm very comfortable where I'm at.
Okay. Well, first of all, I mean, just to get this done, you're wrong. Secondly,
let me get my copy and get my notes out.
You just brushed over a load of stuff, like about your faith and going to synagogue and also training to be a rabbi and then getting kicked out. I need all of that unpacked in, let's say, 3 minutes tops.
Okay. Well, I did an Edinburgh show about this like years ago called Chosen. So I was raised as a Buddhist and then I was at boarding school and all this. And then basically when I was about 16, I got into my Jewish heritage. My mom's Jewish and I was at my grandma's house, which is where I spent a lot of time. And then I think that was part of it as well. She helped sort of nurture that. And then I went out to Israel when I was 18 and I was on kibbutz and I was very much a Zionist. And I was like, I'm going to reclaim the land and we're going to build, I was working at a date plantation on a kibbutz and all stuff. And then I went to this yeshiva, which is a rabbinical school, and they essentially brainwashed me. I thought it was like a cultural kind of like a month where you would learn about stuff, but it was actually this kind of religious indoctrination thing. So I ended up staying there and then I got kicked out because I got caught sleeping with a non-Jewish girl in the dormitories and during Tisha B'Av, which is like one of the holiest days of the destruction of the Second Temple. Anyway, so I've sort of had this, even though I was kicked out, the brainwashing stayed. And so I carried that with me afterwards, but I never really deprogrammed. And I have come from a spiritual background anyway, And for me, it's just like, which direction are you going to take that? I do have an innate sense of something being out there and whatever. Also, the necessity of a moral framework is no bad thing. And then there's identity that ties into it as well. So the kids can reject this stuff later on. And I don't, I certainly don't shove it down their throats apart from it just being part of our lives. But later on, if they go 80, I don't believe in God. But Judaism's never really been, Jewish isn't about believing in God. It's about living your life according to certain moral codes, maybe.
I had no idea, because in my head, it's like the first part of the contract is there's an afterlife and we have to be good.
Yes,
to get
that's
to
a
God's
very
afterlife.
Christian thing. That's the thing. Whereas Judaism, the focus is totally different. Jews don't believe in like this afterlife or this heaven as such. So it isn't like you do good now for later. The idea in Judaism essentially could be summed up as do this stuff now for now. Like, do,
I mean, that's almost quite. But it's almost quite Buddhist in a way,
yeah,
isn't it?
To be
in the moment.
Yeah, there's a book called The Jew in the Lotus, and it's about the connections. But it's almost like do this. It's a much more focus on how to live a good life now, and all that other stuff. And Judaism doesn't go on about. Doesn't really focus at all on the afterlife as such. So
do you sort of believe that God, if you do the right things, God is rewarding you? So the good things that happen in your life are as a result of God?
Not necessarily. No. Again, that really comes down more to gratitude and how you look at things. So I think there's definitely a lot of saying thank yous and stuff when you are praying.
That is almost mindfulness. That is almost the mindfulness
craze. Absolutely. I'd say that's exactly what it is, mindfulness. So there are connections to these other I did Power of Now and and tying it together.
I love this. I could get in on this, Josh. Can I become a Jew? That's okay, isn't it?
That's the catch.
Oh man,
you can cut that. Yeah, they make Jews because it's and the other thing I like about it is a not that you can't proselytize. Like you're not like it's specifically. There's a law against going out there on the corner with a big. Bored and saying God is nigh or whatever the end is like, you cannot you're not allowed to go out there and say all that stuff.
It's got a no PR clause.
And the other thing I like about it is it also doesn't say like Jews are going to heaven and everyone else is going to hell or anything like that. It's like this is the contract that we made with God. This is how we're meant to live our life, but that doesn't mean that anyone else's way of living their life is wrong.
I've learned more about Judaism in the last 4 minutes than I have in the last 41 years. Thanks for coming on the show.
We like to listen to toast, and we're not the kind who would boast. And even in spite of the host, we still like to listen to toast. La, la, la.
Let's have a little skip on ahead then, shall we? What have we got here? 13th of November 2013, the AA Car Essentials L plates.
So this is, this is obviously not going to work on a podcast, but
that's fine. We've got words. Oh, look, there they are.
This is when my wife first threatened to start learning to drive. This was her like effort. And interesting enough, here we are. 9 years later.
How's it going?
And Saturday will be her first driving lesson.
You're joking.
No. So it's taken 9 years to get to this point. From buying those learner plates, she's been threatening to do this tonight. So I do, the kids go to a Jewish school. It's about 20 minutes away, but with parking and all that stuff. It's, for me, it's a 2 hours of my day. Every day for the last 8 years now I've been doing it. And my wife doesn't drive. So now things are getting a little bit busy again. So she is sort of saying she's gonna start doing these driving lessons and stuff, which is great. I'm gonna say something very. I don't believe it's sexist, but I'm sure there'll be people who will disagree.
Great, love that. So we don't shy from controversy. We're GB News. That's fine. Go on.
Yeah, there we go. So she, I don't really or haven't in the past wanted her to drive or haven't been that bothered about it because I don't think I'm worried. If she's going to be a good driver. Now, this is not because she's a woman necessarily, although you could attribute this factor to women maybe more. But she's an optimist. So maybe, are women more optimistic than men? I'm not sure. She married me. She's an optimist. So I think that makes you a bad driver. because you have to be a good driver, you've got to be a pessimist, that you've got to just assume that everybody's a bad driver and someone pulling out of that drive has not seen you, is going to pull in front of you, or the car that's in front of you is going to brake suddenly. You always have to assume the worst.
That is fantastic advice. That is day one when you sit in the car next to your instructor. That's the first thing any instructor needs to say.
And she just assumes the best of humanity. Thinks everybody's good and everybody's got good intentions, or everybody will let her through, or whatever it is. And I'm worried.
I'm sorry, but a smile and a wave is not going to avoid a crash.
And that's what concerns me.
Well, she's going to learn. And what's going to happen is she's going to start learning to drive. She's going to learn this lesson. It could change her entire view of humanity.
No, sure. Yeah, absolutely. But she's going to learn and with our kids in the car and crash or whatever.
Oh, that's true.
You know, whatever. Yeah. So I'm just a little bit. If she drives, it would only be on this school run, which is a straight line there and back. Yeah. So hopefully it wouldn't, you know, there's no motorways or anything.
Fine. How much damage can you do on a 20-minute school run? Really? On 20 miles an hour as well.
She's also got terrible spatial awareness. That might be a... that just might be her. Being from New Zealand and she's very used to open... You know, I'm not saying that's a women's thing, but she's...
Oh my God, you're offending so many people today, Josh.
So many people. She has terrible spatial awareness. And it's sort of... That's been one of the banes of our 20 years together. It's just like this kind of... It's like, and you know, I'm from London and I'm used to weaving in front of round people and also just by being in boarding school, by living, growing up in a room of 12 people, like you have your space and this is it. And you know exactly where everybody is because you could be attacked at any moment by somebody, by a fist just coming. You know, so I'm just, you have this like 360 thing. You know what it's like from boarding school, right? I'm sure you have a similar thing. You're just
You're always making, you don't know where the next attack is coming from.
Yeah.
You're always parking yourself in a little corner and making your little safe corner. I always sleep in the corner. In restaurants, wherever, I have to sit in the corner. I'm a nester, and my nest is about the same size as what I can hold in my hands in front of me. And that is my little world. And everything beyond that, and this is a boarding school thing completely, because it would be like being in the TV room in the 90s. I had my little bit in front of me with whatever, usually snacks. And everything else can go fuck yourself. Everything else could be on fire for all I care.
Absolutely. And when my wife and I, when we moved in together after about a year, like I said, we had this studio flat, like a very tiny room, just a double bed with a little table, and then I'll fit a tiny bathroom and a little tiny kitchen thing. But she couldn't understand. That's the closest we ever came to breaking up during that time, because she couldn't understand how I could be in that space, this tiny space, and still be in my own space. That was so very, so she would, you know, how could I be sitting next, be reading or being, and not engage with her or just have the blinkers down, like that she wasn't there in a way. And that's because that's boarding school for you. I could have 100 people in a tiny room and still be, have, if like you say, you've got that little area in front of you, you've got this, that, then that's enough. And quite she couldn't there. Get it.
Quite happy. I think that's a city dweller thing as well. If I've got space, I start to get a bit dizzy and mad. I'm like a dog. I need to be in my crate.
Yes, exactly. We have been taught well.
So let's see what else we can find here. Josh, a couple of books. This is interesting. You've got AIDS in the 21st Century, Disease and Globalization.
Oh, yeah.
And then you've got HIV and AIDS, Symptoms, Testing, Treatment, Risk Factors, Preventions. Do you want to tell us what's going on here?
Well, this is when I got AIDS. And so I did an Edinburgh show a couple of years ago called AIDS, A Survivor's Story. And the show was about how growing up in the sort of 80s, 90s, and also growing up in my parents worked in the fashion industry, basically everyone we knew, all these like uncle figures, and basically everybody got AIDS and died. And it absolutely traumatized me because... then it was also like everybody, if you're straight, it didn't matter. Like anybody could get it. And so going through puberty at that time, and there's a people who are like my age, 46, 45, 47, whatever.
Yeah.
That it was a very weird time to go through puberty with these insane adverts everywhere. And then
you can't help, but I'm exactly the same age as you. You can't help but tie in sexual development with this apocalypse that seems to be happening around you.
Because it was sexuality. And so it was all like condom use and whatever. Yeah. You know, and then I would, so I did, you know, the joke, you know, I'd be like, you know, now as we know, it's impossible for straight people to die of AIDS or whatever. But at the time, it was like this. So this, I wrote this show because when I was 17, the second girl I ever slept with, after like a week or two, we slept together without a condom. Mm. And she was a year older than me. And I absolutely convinced myself that I was now HIV positive. Right. Like, I was like, she'd slept with like 10 guys and she was also like an actress. And I was like, and those guys, they probably slept with, you know, they probably have orgies or whatever. So I was like totally, totally convinced that. So this was the story. This show was all about that time and growing up around these people dying. Mm. And then the trauma that sort of carried with me. Obviously it was a comedy show. Mm. But it was like, and then it was like the lengths I had to go I was so petrified that I couldn't get tested, and I still have never been tested because I'm still so scared of it. But what
so
I
you
thought,
still deep down think you might be HIV positive?
Yeah, absolutely. And so, but I thought, well, if I can get her tested, then that's how I'll know that I don't have it, you know. And then I convinced myself, and then she wouldn't do it, and I had to like stay with her. And it turns out we really shouldn't have been a couple. I really didn't like each other, but I was like clinging to this relationship to just get her to get tested because I couldn't get tested, and then she did get tested, and then I convinced myself that she was lying because she thought I was going to break up with her. I was totally, totally mental.
Definitely blame the AIDS epidemic on you being mental, Josh. Definitely
yeah,
blame
exactly. Well, being mental plus AIDS epidemic, the two combined together. So I bought, as I do, I'm a big researcher, and I bought a lot of books about AIDS. I really wanted to like know my stuff, and it was really, really interesting. One of them, I don't know which one of those that is, was an amazing book written by this woman who worked for an HIV charity, and it just it's all about her experiences, like trying to like the reality of AIDS now as it is in Africa and whatever, and also her efforts to kind of raise awareness, and it was really, and it was a lot of counterintuitive stuff, and also things like condoms are like different sizes in different countries. Like, I mean, well, I don't know why this is the one factor, but like, you can't say that about, I shouldn't say this at all, sorry, this is going to totally get me cancelled. But let's just say that in Africa, the condoms are a different size to Japan.
Right. Okay.
So it's interesting here where you have a stereotype, and arguably an offensive stereotype, which is then suddenly backed up, I guess, by material reality when it comes to.
And that material reality is important to save lives. Because the other thing that you know, but what has become so such a, I guess, a relief in a way, and so good, is that it's so well dealt with now by science and by medicine. But the problem with that is that the Western world seems to have kind of gone, well, that's fixed, that's over, and it's like, it's really not. It's still a huge problem in
Sub-Saharan Africa, because it's getting the medication to these people. So now it's trying to simplify the medication to be able to get it out there to people. And also it was a really interesting book, because I did anthropology at university, so it was almost anthropological about how different societies dealt with HIV, but also about how it's spread in a different way in different societies. Like in Nigeria, they have a culture of like older men sleeping with like 18, 19 year old girls, because the 19 year old boys don't have money. And this is like, this is like not something that you really want to, you start dealing with some seemingly dodgy stuff, but that is a cultural phenomenon of from that part of Africa, where you get younger women sleeping with older guys very deliberately as a sort of like, they've got money and we'll take them out and pay, you know. That's not a popular thing to say in the Western world that we live in, but that's the reality there. And because of that, you only needed a few of these 40-year-old guys to be HIV positive to then have a massive impact, because they'd have lots of these girlfriends. Yeah. Those girlfriends would eventually sleep with someone their own age. Yes. And then that would, you know, and that's how it, so it was always, it was interesting how different society and also, you know, and their attitudes to contraception and this and that would impact, and drug use in Russia, they wouldn't acknowledge drug use there because they didn't believe in drug, you know, but of course that's how that was. But if you can't acknowledge the problem, then you can't, of course, actually deal with it. And actually, another thing was like how Thatcher actually was actually really on top of it, way ahead of the game, which is an interesting thing. Yeah, like she really got on top of this like stuff a lot earlier, and really wanted to push things further, and was actually held back by her government at the time, like wanting to, you know, they were like giving out free syringes and stuff like that. And things like programs like, were like, she was, because she was a scientist. Yes. And I can't believe I'm saying something because I, you know, such a default anti-Thatcher world that we grew up in. And I grew up in a sort of, in a late, my parents worked for Labour. And, but that thing was, she was way ahead of the game when it came to HIV stuff.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
God, yeah. God, I can't believe you're a Maggie lover. Jesus.
You say, but that's the tribalism of the last few years, of course. Is if
I
you
know,
say anything
I know, I
about
know.
About anything, if you're not this, and that's what, that's the journey I've been on, is like, is breaking out of that somewhat, in that you cannot say or support or say anything good about the other side or anything that doesn't fit that narrative.
And people will, you know, if it's, it's, you know, it's fine. You're on this podcast. It's fine. But, you know, the stuff about what you're talking about, Nigerian relationships, people would say if you were on, say you're on a TV show saying that and it was clipped down and there was no context and it was seen as a lazy stereotype rather than a well-researched problem they're trying to deal with. Like, it's that thing of going, oh my God, just give me a chance before you jump down my throat and assume that I'm being horrific. I'm not being horrific. I'm just like...
There are different cultures that have... these differences have to be acknowledged if you are going to... certainly deal with something like HIV or any, you know.
I completely agree with you. I also think we should move on.
Vitamins B and C and D. Get it for myself, for my health, on the cheap. Gotta stay in shape, but I'm so lazy. Prime online, next day delivery.
We are now in 2015, Josh Howie, and you have spent £200 on the Grand Canyon Park's 6 biggest family tent.
Oh my God.
Oh, it's beautiful, Josh.
This is when you officially become middle class. The moment.
Yes, that, yes.
The big, the massive tent. Still got this tent. It's in our lot. Comes out. We do a lot of camping because we haven't had very much money for a few years. So we are camping 3 or 4 times a year. Got a lot of use out of that tent. Now we suffer from tent envy because there are the blow-up ones, you know, these huge blow-up ones. Our one is still whatever. But this tent
Like a
is
bouncy
like,
castle tent. What?
Yeah, they just like, you just hook them up and they just blow up and they're, you know.
I just, the way that camping is a microcosm of normal life, and you go camping in a kind of, look, we're going to slum it for a couple of days and it'll be fun, kids. Yeah. We're going to be in a field. And then you get there, and this happened to me when I went camping last year, and there was some prick in an SUV parked up next to us who kept his engine rolling because it was powering his portable fridge that was keeping his beers cold. And it's like, mate, you've got diesel pouring into my tent. So you've got some cold Budweiser. Oh, so upsetting.
Yeah. Just go down the local, you know, get the local supermarket last minute and then have a cooler.
I quite like it when there's an intense moment in camping where you're kind of like, okay, there's a kind of, you feel a bit like a group leader. Right, here we go. You need to go over there. You need to get over there. You get that for me. Do you know what I mean? There's quite a lot of activity, which I enjoy. What I don't like is when the activity dies down and you just stand there in a field feeling purposeless and wet. That's what I don't like.
Yeah, that's the toughy thing. And fitting 7 of us in this tent with it. We're all in wet clothes and wet socks. It's like not good.
1st of December 2016, maybe a Christmas present here. Rat and mouse killer. Some nice poison.
Yeah, we got mice, thank you. They're coming from downstairs. So we've got a council flat, ex-council flat, but downstairs still is a council flat, and there's a guy in it. It's a very nice man, but he's basically a hobo who turns out he's been living there illegally for the last 40 years.
Love that. Great stuff.
And so he has a weird thing. He puts his rubbish in a plastic bag in the middle of his kitchen. And this whole flat is falling apart and really smells as well. There's no way he's going to listen to this. So mice, so as much as we kill these mice, they come in because of the staff. And I tried to like, and I said, so he did buy a bin recently. That's a big deal. But it's a bit of a bane because then the mice come in and so I have to sort of constantly... It's not too bad at the moment, although we did see a mouse the other day. And so, you know, when you see one, there's at least 10 or something.
We've got them as well. Yeah. I came in the house last night from walking the dog and it was just, they're getting cockier and cockier. It was just standing by the dishwasher eating. And I looked at him and I was like, mate, this is your cue to run away. And he was like, yeah, I'll take my fucking time.
You start humane and then it just becomes like, I want to torture you. I want to like cut your arms off. I want to, you know, their happiness that when we kill a mouse is just, it's like, that's the best. Yes! Fucking.
You shouldn't kill them. What you need to do is get a post-it note and write the words, buy a fucking bin. Stick it on the mouse. The mouse will go back downstairs to your neighbor.
Yeah.
Your neighbour will think the mice are communicating with them.
Yeah. You know? So that some of that stuff, some of it's really good, some of it isn't. And it's just finding the stuff that will actually sort of kill them and work.
Loads of stuff here. We have got a Make Me Planet board game. We have got some.
Okay, here we go.
Yeah.
Here we go. Now you've hit it. So this is where I've had like a mental breakdown. This has been my midlife crisis. That's where we've reached now.
So many. £38 on the Rajas of the Ganges. Lord of the Zidit board game.
Yep.
Ghost fighting treasure hunters, Ravensburger, Carpe Diem strategy game, Renegade Atlas Enchanted Lands board game. Oh my God.
Good. Yeah. And you know what? This isn't even half. This is what you're seeing is not even half of it. This is the stuff I buy from Amazon because occasionally you get like a better deal on Amazon or when they do like their special days or whatever, yeah. or people sending stock off cheaply. Like through other actual board game shops, like websites and through physical shop. I mean, we're talking thousands and thousands of pounds. And they take up so much space. So all that DVD, Blu-ray book and book buying got transferred. All that collecting, and before then I was collecting comics and I still do collect comics, has all been transferred to board games. That's become my...
Josh,
like it's really bad,
but it's amazing because what's incredible, I've never seen this happen on anyone's Amazon before. Everything else stops apart from Rat Killer, but you're going along, and up to this point you've been buying books about how to write sitcoms, you've been buying books about how to be a stand-up comic, books which you admit yourself most of the time aren't that good, and then suddenly you've gone, fuck it, I'm going to really get into board games with my kids. I love this. This is a sign of a happier person.
I don't know. I mean, I feel pretty exposed at the moment because this is a mental health issue, frankly. I'm embarrassed. Because
why? You're playing with your kids. You've gone bright red.
Yeah,
gone bright red.
I buy so many that if I played a new board game a day with my kids, I still wouldn't get through them all. So it's more than that. It's a collecting thing. And yes, I do play with my kids, but I'm just buying all my hobby, apart from like fighting Corbinites online, the rest of my time is spent like looking up board game reviews, being on this website called Board Game Geek and like looking up stuff, watching videos, watching reviews, finding them, sourcing around, tracking them down from America and Europe because they're like because they only make a limited print run. And if they're out of print, you have to find them, you have to track them. I have to it's all encompassing and it's absolutely taken up like my life or my hobby as such as it is. I stopped reading comics for a while. I'm back reading comics now and I stopped reading at all. Everything has been about board. I stopped buying clothes. It's like, I go, oh, do I want to buy this shirt or do I want to buy a board game? It's like, it's insane. And like I say,
Where has this come from? Did you have a latent interest that was sort of dormant? And can I just say, what I'm seeing as you sort of start to get intense about it, you remind me of the Josh Harry of 2002 talking about accruing gigs.
Yeah.
This is who I'm seeing.
Okay, again. Spencer Brown, you know Spencer, obviously he's a comic as well.
Oh, lovely.
So sort of start at the same time. A couple of years ago, I went to his house around that time, obviously, 6 years ago or so, and he was like, oh, do you want to play a board game? And I was like, but he's like, no, it's not like what you think, like it's kids, it's strategy and whatever. And then he showed me this cupboard and he had like 20 board games in this cupboard. And I was like, what, you got 20 board games? Like what, how much is that board game? He's like, oh, that's £30. I was like, wait a sec, are you telling me you've got £600 I couldn't believe it. Like I was like, you are literally the most insane person I've ever met. And I look back at that now and I compare it to me with literally board games just coming out of my ass and the amount of money that I've spent and just the amount of time that it takes up. And I'm just like, oh my God. It's like,
does this happen?
It's a midlife crisis. It's an absolute midlife crisis. And then we played a game and we played it. I was like, oh yeah, I sort of see it. And I just got addicted to it. So it tied into the collecting side and I tied into this kind of analytical, mathy, crunchy, the enjoyment side of it and spending time with the kids. But also like tonight we're going to go out, we're playing this new game called Golem, which is like my birthday present was like imported in from Germany and no one's got it in the UK. And it's like this, you know, it'll take an hour to explain the rules. It's going to take me an hour to read the rules. It's going to take an hour.
Would you play with the kids?
No, with the eldest one, I traumatized him. I bought the Star Wars game and he was six and it took about 3 hours to just explain the rules to a six-year-old. I mean, I can't even believe I did that. But that was. But this will take an hour to explain the rules, and then the game itself will probably take 2.5 hours. And that's going to be the best night of my month. It's bad, man. It's I'm not proud of it. I feel ashamed.
You're very intense, Josh. Whether you're a Buddhist or you are going back to train as a rabbi, or you are a stand-up comic, or you are a breeder, and now you're a board gamer. This is what you do, isn't it?
Do everything 110%, absolutely. Find that thing and just go for it.
And to finish today, you are now happily 0% hair, all thanks to our final purchase of the show on the 24th of January 2022, the Philips 7-in-1 all-in-one trimmer. It's the Series 3000 grooming kit for beard and hair. And Josh, looking at you now, you've done a great job. There's no beard there anymore. You had a great beard, that's gone.
It's gone, yeah. The beard was, I like the beard, I'm missing it. There's a slight double chin that's appeared in the last year since I've had the beard. As you say, I'm about to go off and filming this Netflix thing that's on its second series, and I need to look a bit younger than the beard. I've got it's a bit white now, my beard. So the beard gives me gravitas and makes me seem intelligent, which is good for my other job, which is doing this show on GB News, this headliners thing, which is like going through the news, and that's really fun. But the beard had to go for at least for the next month. It's about another, we've done 2 weeks and we've got another month or so of filming and then I can get the beard back.
You know what you should do on GB News? Take those board games into GB News. Just do some of those live on GB News. That would be better.
Oh, well, then tax deductible. I've tried to get this stuff to be taxed, like I've done tried to do a podcast.
Oh,
then
it's done. Yeah, done.
Pilot. Yeah, it's like, just so I can claim back on tax for these.
Why do you think I did this podcast? Everything I buy on Amazon goes through my tax. Easy peasy. Genius, mate. Genius. Listen, Josh Harry, you are a star. Thank you so much for joining me on My Mate Bought a Toaster. What a journey. What a journey, Josh. Any final comments?
It's such a good idea that shows your purchases define who you are to a degree. Yeah. And they have. They absolutely have. That's what's so great about this idea. It's so good.
Josh, you're brilliant. Thank you very much for coming on the show. Lovely to see you again.
You too, man.
It's my mate, bought a toaster. Oh, it's my mate, bought a toaster.
Josh Howie, guys, what a top guy. I hope you enjoyed that episode. Thank you very much for listening. Sorry, this is always the same, isn't it, at the end? Thanks, guys. I've had lots of lovely tweets, as usual, this week, which has been really nice. And please, if you get a second, do hop on and give us a nice 5-star review, because the more 5-star reviews we get, someone was explaining to me an algorithm this week. I don't really understand it, but it helps. So if you feel that way, then please do jump on your podcast provider and give us a 5-star review. It really, really helps. Next week, I'm going to be interviewing Maisie Adam. This episode is already up in full at patreon.com/toasterpod. And it's very, very funny indeed. Maisie Adams, a wonderful stand-up comic. And we talked about all sorts of stuff. There's an incredible lava lamp story. And, there's this. A story about her time working in Fat Face. And she basically describes me. So any other middle-aged dads who shop in Fat Face, prepare to be seen.
We used to get a lot of dads. This used to happen a lot. We used to get a lot of dads who, whilst they were at the till paying, would show how cool they were by indicating that they knew the song that was playing, because Fat Face has a certain playlist that's very, a lot of Ben Howard going on there. Yeah. We've got a lot of Ben Howard.
Hello, Ben Howard, mate. Go on, keep him coming.
A bit of Passenger, that kind of thing. And you used to get a lot of blokes tapping on the till whilst their card was authorising.
Is this James Morrison, mate? Yeah, I know this
literally,
one. Yeah.
Just tapping the pin in and then going, only know when to lie when you're feeling low. Only miss a home when you're missing home.
I love it.
Yeah. Do you want your seat in the bag, Jeremy?
So that's Maisie Adam, who is going to be my guest next week. The full episode already up at patreon.com/toasterpod. Only £4 for the basic toaster pod package. And also, there's extra Josh Howey footage that's up there as well, exclusive to Patreon. So go and check that out. If you get a sec, see you next Wednesday. Lots of love now.